Welcome to On the Edge with SICK, the podcast where we explore individuals and organizations on the edge of social innovation through a design lens. We're your hosts, Nita and Sylvia, co-founders of SICK.
I want to introduce you, Dr. Liliana Rodriguez. I met Liliana a few years ago. Liliana Rodriguez is an award-winning senior service designer and user-centered design leader working for National Health Service England for digital medicines. Her education includes a bachelor in product design and master in interaction design, and finally a PhD in digital service. Liliana was working in commercial non-profit and higher education environments on design projects in health, government digital services, and innovation for a small and medium enterprise. She is also an associate lecturer at the Open University of UX and Interaction and Design Thinking Models. Thank you, Liliana, for being here with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Herman, and On the Edge team for having me today.
Yes, thank you, Liliana. We start with asking all of our guests, what does On the Edge mean to you?
First, thanks for inviting me to take part in your podcast. On the Edge means to me that the horizon is open in front of me. It is like a menu in a good restaurant that I haven't tried yet. On the Edge also means that even though I don't know what exactly awaits for the ahead, it is pretty intriguing and I might jump or fly to get there and to find out. You guys with this podcast have found a very interesting area to combine design and health. We are on the edge of this area of knowledge.
Thank you. That's wonderful that you said that.
Yeah, I love how you brought our podcast into your explanation around On the Edge. And it's something that we definitely think about all the time, how to combine design and health. And I think that you have done that a lot in your background. So to start with, we wanted to dive into your background and your work. Can you tell us briefly about your professional journey?
Yes, I'm passionate about design. Since I started my BA in product design back in Colombia in 1986, the product design profession has changed its paradigms. The design has shifted its attention from products to services, moving from the analog to the digital world. I have seen how designers have expanded their activity scope from the industrial and commercial realm towards the social and political sphere. I have witnessed and partaken in the evolution and consolidation of interaction and service design as design disciplines. By keeping updating and learning new skills and integrating them with previous experience, I did a master in interaction design at Domus Academy, and since then, in the past 17 years, I have been involved in services design projects. Mm-hmm. I did a PhD studying the phenomenon of technology appropriation of digital services, most precisely startups. Technology means internet and social media, and appropriation, how users appropriate the internet and the social media within a digital service. Within the PhD, I developed my design research skills and focused in the digital realm, moving further from physical products. So to summarize, I'm passionate about the design of digital services. And since 6 years ago, since I started working with clinicians, I'm more and more passionate about the design of services for health.
That's amazing. Thanks, Liliana. I love how you shifted your work aligned with how design has really shifted from a product to more of a service focus and more of a digital focus. So what would you say is the biggest challenge facing you in the work that you do right now?
In the services design area, one challenge is to value the role of the designers within the multidisciplinary team. Co-design and participatory approaches have shifted the role of the designer towards being more like a facilitator of the design process. But we still need to consider that the design decisions and development of the service and the touch points of the service should be given to the person within the team that knows how to better design. This doesn't mean that the others within the team are less or more creative. It means that knowing how to design is the designer's expertise. Design projects can be in many contexts and areas of knowledge. A designer can learn many things from different areas of knowledge while doing these projects, but that doesn't not make us as clinicians, psychologists, etc. So if you are an expert in a knowledge area and take a design thinking course, that doesn't make you a designer. It makes you closer to the way a designer thinks and works, but again, it does not give you the rest of the skill. For example, we have human factors, aesthetics, ergonomy, all important factors in the development of a product, a service, etc. If you are interested in this debate, there is a recording of a Druid conference in research on innovation. That is a good place to see the different positions. Maybe the podcast could have the link so then people could start looking into this if they're interested.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We'll have links to some of the resources that I'm sure you'll mention as we go through our conversation around this. But that's a great thing to point out, the role of the designer versus the role of the clinician. And it's something that I personally struggle with because I started off in my career as a clinician and then still trying to learn about design after doing a master's in design. But I don't think of myself as a designer, and I definitely want to partner with people who are experts in that field, like yourself and the others on this call, my colleagues.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We did a paper, which is we asked the clinicians in these projects that we will talk about later on, about the valuing of design and the design process. Maybe people will be interested to read that paper as well. Again, the link could be the podcast.
Yeah, the show notes. So we're going to move on to your projects. Herman, did you want to introduce the first one?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Liliana, we understand you have worked in some projects around people living with HIV, also with clinician and user between 2016 and 2018. Could you be shared with the experiences on those projects? What was the best, the worst, and what did you learn?
Yes, Herman, I'm going to focus in two of those three projects that I did. They were part of an interdisciplinary collaboration, as you were mentioned, that evolved where the use of design tools and methods such as user workshops and user journeys, scenarios, personas, and interaction mockups were employed. A group of health workers, clinicians, and designers team up to develop novel ways to respond to HIV prevention, diagnosis, and HIV stigma emerging challenges. We integrated creative, participatory, user-centered design approaches and tools with scientific and clinical expertise to address these challenges. When I talk about we designers, I mean Carlos Peralta, PhD Cantab, and me. The two projects, the first one is currently called Vending Machine to Dispense HIV Cell Test. This project started at the Martin Fisher Foundation, and I was funded by the Public Health of England. The Martin Fisher Foundation's vision is to eliminate new HIV cases within a generation, something which is called Towards Zero, by increasing HIV testing through improving knowledge of HIV, increasing availability to PrEP, and reducing HIV stigma.
So what is PrEP?
PrEP is a series of medication that people could take before they could have a relationship with someone, so then they won't get the HIV.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just want to define it.
Yes. The clinicians that work at the Elton John Center and Brighton and Sussex University hospitals did have a walk-in sexual health clinic set up at the sauna that is frequented by men that have sex with men to encourage them to take the test, but it was not private and people did not interact with the staff as it was needed. So basically, novel strategies were needed to increase HIV testing in high-risk groups like the MSN, and meet goals to reduce undiagnosed HIV infection. Mm-hmm. HIV cell testing is an attractive strategy to enable user autonomy in the high-risk group, as I mentioned before. the men that have sex with men in the United Kingdom community setting. The project aimed to develop a pilot service to encourage HIV self-testing among this group. It included a series of design workshops involving members of the LGBT community and people living with HIV. The final design involved the building and testing of a bespoke vending machine to distribute free self-tests and its digital interface. The vending machine is unique in that during the interaction, it collects anonymous user information, age, sex, sexuality, town of residence, and testing history, which can inform HIV services in the future. The world's first touchscreen machine has been distributing free HIV self-tests at the Brighton Sauna since 2017. In 2018, four more machines were fitted at Sublime, the Marlborough Pub and Theatre, and the Rainbow Hub and Prowler to ensure more widespread access to HIV tests. This project has won the BMJ British Medical Journal 2018 Innovation Award. And the vending machines have been instrumental in enabling to expand access to HIV testing and support individuals to take control of their sexual health. For those reluctant to access traditional healthcare settings, placing them in the community venues has reduced stigma and barriers to HIV testing while facilitating confidentiality, privacy, and convenience.
For your second project there, Liliana, can you talk about the... You have a hashtag here, Making HIV Stigma History.
This second project, it was mainly an awareness campaign. It intended to reduce HIV stigma and discrimination using digital resources disseminated via social media platforms and relevant to the general population. A series of short factual films and animations were produced to run across social media platforms with the aim of reducing misconception and challenging current perspectives about HIV. By improving knowledge and reducing fear, the Martin Fisher Foundation hopes to create an HIV stigma-free society and encourage more people to come forward to testing. According to Public Health of England, 12% of people living with HIV in England are unaware of their diagnosis. The Making HIV Stigma History campaign mantra, "We learn, we think, we change," emphasizes how important it is for everyone to have a correct information about HIV and to share this message. The Martin Fisher Foundation aims to change the emphasis from whether individuals are positive, negative, and dirty and clean to whether they are tested and untested. The interdisciplinary team consists of clinicians, sociologists, patients, biographers, an illustrator, social media specialists, the press, and the Brighton Gay Parade organization. The project started with a baseline survey about the knowledge and perception that the general public has on what it is to be living with HIV and to understand the roots of the HIV stigma. The data of the survey was used in one of the videos, up-to-date HIV facts. We organized, planned, and executed a series of participatory and co-design workshops to gain insight into the HIV stigma, to generate ideas for the campaign, and to create real scenarios for the videos. The participants were people living with HIV and the general population in Brighton. The stories of the videos, the content, and the campaign messaging, slogans, and brand features were the results of these workshops.
Thanks, Liliana. This sounds really, really, really amazing. And I have been thinking, what were the outcomes of this project? What is the main conclusion, the impacts? Could you share?
Yes, Herman. The vending machines have been instrumental in enabling to expand access to HIV testing and support individuals to take control of their sexual health. For those reluctant to access traditional healthcare settings, placing them in the community venues has reduced stigma and barriers to HIV testing while facilitating confidentiality, privacy, and convenience. The world's first touchscreen machine has been distributing free tests, HIV cell tests, at the Brighton Sauna since 2017. In 2018, four more machines were fitted, as mentioned before, and the project, I said, was won the British Medical Journal for Innovation Award in 2018. Several review papers have been published in health journals including the WHO in 2018. A list of the links can be provided in the link. The Martin Fisher Foundation has now newly developed combined sexual health and HIV digital vending machines. There are other news. They have started to place machines abroad, within the first HIV vending machine going to New Zealand, followed by Japan, and now two machines are in Zambia. Now the HIV has grown its campaigns. There will be a link in the podcast. The Martin Fisher Foundation bus, the U equals U, which is, and the Martin Fisher Foundation training resources for health workers. I want to think that the lessons learned while working with us have helped them in the projects they have embarked since our collaboration.
Yeah, probably. I'm just wondering, what did this have any kind of impact on the testing rates among this population of men who have sex with men?
This is towards zero spread, and they have great news. By the end of 2022, they have helped to achieve that 95% of people living with HIV in Brighton and Hove knowing their status, 99% of people being on effective treatment, 99% of people with HIV on treatment being unable to pass the infection on to others due to untraceable levels of virus in the bloodstream. That's the U equals U.
That's incredible, actually. So this is really important work, for sure.
I have a small question, Lily. I think you have told us the machine is in other countries. How was the response for the in these different cultures and behaviors and contexts?
Germán, you are right. Contexts are completely different. The one we work with the clinicians was specifically in the UK. So for example, for the machines in Zambia, I don't really know exactly what is the situation, but I know Zambia is a country that has high levels of HIV. In Zambia, the machine impact is still not decided, as people still prefer to go to shamans and tribal curanderos for cures. The linkage to care, which is the main aim of it, is still limited. It's a very challenging environment. I think they use mainly what we started, but for sure they must have changed the strategy. It is incredible, and there's a lot of more women that actually live with the virus. So then that's also should have a different approach, yes. In Japan, right from the beginning, it was clear that the machines should provide other healthcare products, as people would be too afraid from social stigmatization should they be seen using the machines providing only HIV tests. You were asking me as well as the impact from the second project as well. So for the Making HIV Stigma History, the ripples of this campaign is still there since it created interest in the media. But basically, the outputs of this campaign literally were two surveys conducted before and after the campaign that showed that the campaign was effective in updating information of HIV in the general population. The stigma SOAR, which is, and also the campaign slogan and the mantra, are now successful and enduring brand that can be used to identify future anti-stigma efforts. Online response rates show that the campaign was highly effective and generating digital engagement through its social media platforms. The campaign produced digital user-generated content as well, and the creation of an ongoing and a broader program of work that the platform is ready to incorporate and take forward. The videos impact post-launch have been focusing on educational activities. The videos have been used in activities with health professionals, for example, the HIV training offered by the HIV unit to local GPs, the general practitioners, and there are potential for further development in this space is ongoing for UNAIDS fast-track stigma work in Brighton. The outputs for this campaign were literally 6 videos that were created, 7 digital platforms, and a digital strategy. The campaign has its own website. The campaign participated in the Brighton Pride, as far as I understand, three years in a row. And a podcast was also part of the outputs. The podcast is called Stigma Shorts. Again, a link will be created so then people could actually access the podcast.
And is this something that's going to be launched in other countries as well?
No, but what I do know is, for example, this year, they did have HIV Stigma Day. It's in the whole UK. It's called Zero HIV Stigma Day of Action. And it was, Friday, 21st of July. They have a lot of ripples. We have not assessed the impact of the campaign internationally. However, we received several requests to translate the videos in other languages. This can be seen as an indication that the campaign have an international reach.
Okay. But this will be investigated in other countries as well, just to see what type of strategy would have to be used.
Well, the UK normally, when it leads things like this, it always create a ripple in other places, and and people are getting interested in what we do over here. So I imagine yes.
Okay, I think that would be amazing to make this international across different countries, like you're doing with the vending machines as well. So this is great work. Liliana, I wanted to ask you, what's your next project?
That's a really good question. At the moment, I'm working as a senior services designer at the National Health Service in England in a work stream which is called Digital Medicines and its interoperability. I've been developing services that combine physical and digital realms and with a real impact in the society. What I'm doing at the moment is working on the redesign and restructure of the electronic prescription service website of the program. I already did work in the Interop Medicines website. So then, that's what I'm doing. That's my current and next project.
We want to work with you. That's not really amazing.
What is really interesting about this project is one of the goals was to demonstrate the value of the user-centered design approach by bringing the whole team on the journey and co-creating a new vision of the program for adoption of the Interop medicine. And that's one of the things we've been working really hard to help people understand how they can use the user-centered design approach within this program.
Yeah, this approach between physical and digital is so important, and is a huge challenge. And I think is the way in the future.
Yes, absolutely. The UK government is very interested in something which is called Mobile First, and is really a project that just started to really wrap up and become the central focus of the NHS digital review, which and is how can we empower the users into the health journey.
So we're going to move towards wrapping up this episode, and I want to thank you, Lily, for joining us and for sharing your expertise as a designer for health services with a particular focus on two key projects related to HIV, the vending machine project and reducing stigma, which is still so important over 40 years since HIV has been around. What would you say, given all of your experience related to service design, what's one key takeaway that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I have quite a few. So, for example, one takeaway would be how different disciplines can work together and the experts can bring their expertise guided by the design process. And this literally is how interdisciplinary is so important and in any design project, but especially on health. Mm-hmm. Also that the designer's expertise is design and the design process. And the third one is the user involvement. It should be in the different stages and phases of the design process, and it is key in the development and implementation of digital services. This is in order to, if you want to involve the users in the process, then you need to use co-design and participatory design approaches. Yeah, that's highly recommended.
Yeah, there's just so much value in involving users throughout every stage of the process. And yeah, I agree, that's definitely key. So to learn more, as you mentioned, a lot of different links throughout our conversation, which is amazing, and we'll have those in our show notes. But how can our listeners connect with you specifically?
Well, I do have my website, and again, the link will be below. And then also my LinkedIn account. So then it's called Lulu Gaia.
Okay, can you spell that?
Lulugaia. So then in LinkedIn, they can find me with my name as well.
That's also cute.
Is there any meaning behind that?
It is, actually. It's a friend, a common friend that we had with her man, which is Claudio Teikul, used to call me Lulu. And I really love the way she just changed Liliana to Lily to Lulu. And the Gaia comes from Isaac Asimov, which is, he did a series of sci-fi books, which they call The Foundation. And in, I think it's the sixth of the books of The Foundation, it talks about a planet which is called Gaia. It's a very interesting approach.
I didn't know you were into sci-fi, so that's...
Oh, I love sci-fi.
Cool thing, maybe.
What's your favorite book or movie?
The Foundations of Asimov. Yeah, that's like my favorite one. And the movie would be Blade Runner, the original one, the first.
I've never seen Blade Runner. I have been working with that movie a lot of times with my students.
Amazing, yes.
It's so great.
And as I would say, Motti is my favorite. I think Harrison Ford was really angry because I don't remember the name of the actor, you know, that was the replicant. But he actually got the spotlight instead of Harrison Ford in that movie.
Thank you,
Lynn. And the team. Thanks for having me here. It's been amazing.
Thank you for listening to On the Edge with your hosts, Nita and Sylvia. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others or drop a comment and rating. Head over to sickhealth.ca to learn more about SICK and check out all the links and resources in the episode show notes. Thanks, and stay tuned for future podcast episodes with On the Edge with SICK.